to talk about the matter on community television. He just seemed to have little recollection of what went on. And of course, the same phenomena happened with Chair Bill Christie when he made the press conference statements about witnesses Schultz and Buckaloo being in the fourth car back or something, false statements that, you know, could be natural human error, but it seemed strange in a public press conference setting that those kinds of errors would come out and then not be corrected, by the way. We've sent letters to the board requesting corrections and getting none. Some of us were concerned that the process of doing this, that the board had the power at any time in these meetings to open them up, provided, of course, it was not openly revealing the IA files that they were discussing. Is that your understanding?
Well, obviously this is a public body, so that everything that they do has to be done in public except for the reviewing of confidential materials. Now, in this particular case, it was an exceptional case in that most of the internal affairs investigation itself was based on the DA's investigation, which became public. So technically, the board could have discussed and deliberated on the DA's file in public, but they could never discuss and deliberate the IA file portion of the file in public. So it becomes a very difficult thing, because if you're discussing something, if you're in public, you have to be very cautious about revealing confidential information. So I think that's probably the reason why the board didn't do it.
But the issue never actually came up, right?
I don't think any board member brought it up to me. I don't recall anybody bringing that up. I recall people bringing it up afterwards, public people saying, well, why didn't you guys deliberate in public?
Well, actually, we were hoping, and we had assumed, as did many council members, that you would recommend, if not an independent investigation, at least public hearings, so that we could see the deliberative process of the board and come to understand why they were making up their minds.
That's not quite true, Robert. The purpose of a public hearing is not to for the board to deliberate in public. The purpose of a public hearing is for the board to collect information. Then they would go into closed session to deliberate. So,
but they don't have to go into closed session to deliberate, provided they aren't discussing IA materials, correct?
That technically is correct, yeah.
Or they could have, shall we say, a closed section of the deliberations where they refer to the IA materials and then go public and discuss the matter, particularly in the Dine case where, as you point out, most of it was public, say, well, there are IA materials that would lead us to believe this, and not specify what those materials are, but then discuss the rest of the matter publicly.
Yeah, that was a possibility.
And was not done.
No, it wasn't.
Some of us are hopeful that the board, understanding a lot of the continuing suspicion and confusion around the case, might be willing to hold a public discussion around the case and discuss why it came to the conclusions it did, given the understanding that most of the material is public and that they could discreetly walk around the material that is not. What do you think of this idea?
You'd have to talk to the board. That would be up to them.
You, on the other hand, were present at these. You have a sense of how much of this was public and how much was private. Do you think this would be a tenable thing to do in this case?
I think it would be very difficult. I think it would be extremely difficult to sort the two out, and board members would have to consider every word they spoke before they said anything in public. And it would be a very difficult thing to do.
It would, however, be possible, for instance, for the police department and the officers involved, or just specifically the police chief, to say, okay, we think the material in these files, given the public interest in this case, should be made public, and they could do so themselves, correct?
I don't think they can violate state law, Robert. It's not a local law. This is a state law, state personnel rules, and that's what makes these IA investigations confidential. And I don't think the chief can just circumvent that.
Well, so now you're saying that the idea of getting this police radio tape public could not be done either because of state law?
Whether the radio tape is... See, I'm not sure the radio tape was part of the IA file. It was something that the board requested, so I guess it is part of the IA file. So probably not, Robert. When I think about it now, in that light, that would be... It's covered by the state law. It's part of the personnel.
But can't you waive confidentiality? Isn't that a provision also here?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'd say a lawyer would have to advise someone on that because I don't know. Yeah.
Outreach committee met on Monday. Anything come out of that as far as you know?
Sylvia Radloff was elected chair of the outreach committee. They're working on a mission statement. They're working on a outline of presentation material that all board members could follow to do outreach presentations. They're going to be soliciting information from the full board about...
has there been any concern about doing actual outreach, getting their butts out into the community? Have they made any plans or schedules to get out there? Forgive me for putting it so colloquially.
If you let me finish, I was just about to get to. One of the recommendations of the outreach committee, I believe, is going to be to develop a list of outreach potential places, so whether it's at community meetings, groups, they need to prioritize what kind of outreach they want to do and where they're going to do it.
It sounds like elaborate bureaucraties in terms of the fact that there are obvious places which three or four of us could sit down and find in about 5 minutes and decide whether we wanted to go there or not. The board has been in existence for, 3 years now? Is that correct?
3.5.
Right.
There's some people of us who feel that, board members are sort of chalking up little credentials for their next whatever they're doing, whether they're at a university or engaging in political office, as Michael Hernandez is, that there is no real attempt to get anything done whatsoever around the outreach question, or any other question, for that matter,
You're certainly free to come to the outreach committee meetings,
Why would anyone bother if their agenda doesn't actually involve getting out to any sites in the near future?
Well, you seem interested in what they're doing, so if you're interested, you ought to come.
Well, I've been frequently at the meetings, and I have no problem. Well, I do have a problem going to meetings where nothing happens, and where the illusion to the public is being given that something is happening when nothing is going on. Or when the contrary is going on, when police actions are being covered up and not being truly discussed so public can see what's going on. That, however, is my view, and I don't expect you to take that view because I know that you're employed by this group to try to get some matters done. I'm not quite sure what matters are getting done, but I do appreciate your sharing what you are doing. Anything you want to say about anything that's happened recently in the police review board, do you think the public should know about, or anything at all about the board?
Well, I think there are some really important issues that coming up for the board that if people are interested in the police review process, they need to come to the meetings and voice their opinion, because there are some definite important issues that are going to determine the direction that the board goes.
What issues are those?
At the next meeting, which happens on March 9th at 5:30 at City Council Chambers, the board is going to be making a decision on whether the IA officer should be present at review meetings, and I think this is an extremely important topic, and the board needs to hear from the public about it.
Mm-hmm.
They're also going to be discussing the hearing procedures and whether to revise those hearing procedures.
In what way that might interest the public?
It's hard for me to say. The board feels like the hearing procedures are overwhelming, and they're looking at ways to either streamline them or maybe
You mean for public hearings, you mean?
Yes.
Well, since they've never had a public hearing, and they never seem to be interested in doing it even in a murder case, why should we even sit around and listen to them to discuss regulations?
Maybe you shouldn't. Maybe we should just turn the tape off and go away. I mean, you're asking me, so, I'm just telling you what.
I'm not trying to be personally hostile to you, Gary. You understand I'm quite hostile to what the board has been doing, and unfortunately, you are in the middle, and I appreciate your position here. You, on the other hand, also have to appreciate mine, I think.
Well, so anyway, the hearing procedures, I think, are important. The board feels like they're cumbersome, that they're unwieldy. They're looking for ways to make this a useful tool that they feel like they can use. So. That's for discussion.
Right.
They're also going to be discussing the community forum, which is the last component of their ongoing training and scheduling and the format that forum is going to take.
And that was Gary Yamane, Citizens Police Review Board staff member, talking to me last week about the Happy John Dine case, what he could say about it, which wasn't much, about what the board did and didn't do, what it's planning to do, and it ain't much. Again, it's a lot of bureaucratic talk. They're talking about changing procedures that they've never used and didn't even choose to use in a murder case, namely the procedures for a public hearing. So they're spending all their time elaborately working on regulations that are not being put into practice anyway, and it sounds like they're much more interested in formal activity, stuff dealing with process and regulations, than dealing with the substance of complaints that are coming up, with the reality of police abuse. And it's really sad, but that's what's going on. Their next meeting, for those who are interested, is a week from tomorrow, a week from Monday on the 9th of March. It's at 5:30 at the City Hall, City Council Chambers. You can always go there. It's at 809 Center Street, right across from the main library, right across from the Civic Center Auditorium. And you can also phone in your view to the Citizens Police Review Board that it perhaps should resign en masse, and resign as a group, and actually stop the charade that's going on. Its phone number is 429-3262, and they have a message line, so you can call up on that and leave a message at any time, 429-3262. I continue to suggest that people turn in complaints about police misconduct to them, not because I have any illusion that anything's going to happen in a positive way to remedy that situation, but because it creates a record and it puts the officers on notice that something somewhere is appearing in their file, a file that we can't read, that is used to make secret information that should be made public, but that still remains there, for example, can be exposed in the courts in so-called pitches motions, where if cops are on trial or cops' testimony is being disputed and they're involved in a case, you can get a court order to look at past records of complaints against those officers. So I suppose it has that value. I really tried to get a sense from Gary, who was, inside this closed process, whether a reasonable person would believe that it's credible to believe that the police department's story, that Dine was reaching for a weapon. That's not the police department's story, it's the police review board's story, but I guess that's Officer Carey's story, the man who shot Happy John Dine. And, of course, Gary was, restricted from providing any information, but he seemed to feel that he was convinced that a preponderance of the evidence indicated that all police practices were followed, and that that there was a real... He didn't go so far as just to say that, he believed that Dine was drawing a gun or holding a weapon out there. He seemed very uncomfortable talking about the whole thing and rather angry with me for persisting in discussing it. He felt I was arguing with him, when in fact, as you can hear from the tape, I wasn't really arguing at all. I was trying to raise certain issues, like I haven't yet written that letter to the police department, although you will read my letter in the City on a Hill column, read at least my comment that I'm publicly requesting the police chief and the police officers involved to make public the transmission, the radio transmission tape, because there's some indication that maybe that, since that was the only really new piece of evidence that the police review board got that isn't in the library that I'm aware of, and we've read what's in the library, and it certainly doesn't justify believing that the police, either the first story, that Dine was pointing a weapon at the police in a combat stance in a threatening way, or the second story, that he was reaching for one, unless you simply believe the police officer's stories. And I guess there was one other witness who saw some unconfirmed motion or some uncertain motion from Dine. But what we need is the radio transmission tapes as well to hear the kind of conversations that were going back and forth between the police department and the officers involved on the scene, Carey and Over. And I made that request of the police chief in this letter to the paper. I'm also going to make it in another letter to him directly. And now it seems that even that may be regarded as, state law will prohibit that, is now what Gary may be saying. I don't know. What do you think? Becky, you're back in the studio with us. You've been really instrumental, and you wrote a long article on this Dine case for Street Spirit. What do you think of all this?
Well, I think the tape is very important, and that we should take some efforts to find out what the content of that tape is, because if you look through the police reports, there are several instances where various officers indicate that they called in at a certain time and they made a certain statement on the police radio at that time. What we need to verify is that Officer Over and Officer Carey, as they were riding in the car with Ben Newman in the back seat, were indeed calling in on the police radio a description of an unknown person, clothing, who may be armed. That should be on there. They claimed in their testimony that it was on there. That would confirm their statements of the circumstances that preceded the shooting.
Well,
it would also help to get the timing right about how these events unfolded.
Well, you know, call me naive or trusting, but it's really hard for me to believe that the police review board didn't, who said that they got a tape that actually had, you know, full transmissions on it, unlike the one we got, which was blank, largely, that they would not look into that. I mean, perhaps we can even assume that there was a call, you know, man seen brandishing a weapon is now, you know, we're now proceeding to Soquel and Front Streets, call for backup or whatever. We don't know what it was said, but I would have to assume that it is in accord with their statements. Otherwise, at least one member of the police review board would have noticed the discrepancy and said, hey.
Well, I wouldn't count on that. They didn't have any comment over several of the witnesses saying that they saw Officer Over go up to the body of John Dine lying on the sidewalk and fumble around around where his fanny pack is and throw something out on the sidewalk. That's so questionable what he was doing, and there was no real explanation of it in the testimony. Let's say Carey, Over, and Newman. Newman didn't even mention it. Carey said that he thought the gun was found between the legs, and Over claims he found it fairly quickly, but the people who witnessed it described it as a strip search.
Well, of course, again, we're talking about disbelieving testimony of non-police witnesses. This would be, if the police officers, I think they did say that they called in certain things, that's what you're telling me. I don't remember their specific testimony. I haven't reviewed it recently. But if they made the claim that they were calling in a testimony about a man armed with a weapon or reportedly brandishing a weapon, then I think that, not to be confirmed by the police dispatch tape, and not to be noticed by the police review board, would be almost a different order of incompetence or collusion than, let's say, not believing non-police witnesses who say that that Over reached inside and pulled out a gun. I mean, they could say, oh, well, these people didn't see it clearly. Maybe they have an axe to grind. It was dark. Now, maybe he was doing something else. But
Martin Over or Ben Newman were lying.
But When we go to the police officers themselves, for the discrepancy becomes very clear if they said they made a call and they did not. I would think that the police review board would probably notice that, and at least one member of the police review board, perhaps Alan Lang, would be able to, we would hope that this would get confirmed or not confirmed. Of course, the whole problem is the whole veneer of secrecy, the whole you know, shroud that makes this also, you know, impossible to probe through, which we have to blame the Citizens Police Review Board for, because they declined to hold public hearings, at which point officers giving public testimony, it would no longer be a part of their IA file, they would be re-questioned, and the public could hear our officer Over say, yes, I did call in, here it is on the tape, there it is, and the issue would be resolved. No, I did not open up his fanny pack and pull out a weapon and throw it to the ground, instead I did this. I may have said this before, but I was mistaken, or whatever. And the same, and we could have actually seen in a public process what was going on in terms of the actual testimony. And then, perhaps equally important, although maybe less important, because we would actually have seen the testimony, we could hear the board deliberating in terms of what it felt to be important and what not important. and why it weighted one witness's testimony more heavily than another. All questions that are completely shrouded in darkness in the current situation. So that was the Citizens Police Review Board and the Happy John Dine update. Now we're going to play you a little something from Santa Monica. And in Santa Monica, there are lots of things have been happening. There's been the arrival of a London-based foreign corporation with a kind of a newspaper called The Big Issue, a weekly that's sort of a glitzy people-style paper with a little bit of social commentary sold by homeless people, which has got homeless newspapers worried because they're afraid that when this shows up, people will buy this and the real homeless newspapers written by homeless people, decisions made by homeless people, sold by homeless people will die. The question has really arrived in Santa Monica with the arrival of The Big Issue, which is its first appearance in the United States. And here's activist Jennifer Wagner talking about that. Well, we hope that they're going to be talking about it. Perhaps the tape is defective. We're looking for a... come on, baby. We're hoping it will come on shortly. While we're waiting, it's 96.3 FM. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm going to have my technician here check this tape out. And while she's checking the tape out, I'll turn to another subject, one that we kind of began to look into, and people are kind of talking about around Santa Cruz, the issue of the decriminalization or legalization or re-legalization of cannabis and the plight of the cannabis clubs that are providing medical marijuana and are currently under assault from both federal and state authorities. I ran into an activist who actually was involved in Santa Barbara in a nationwide walk for homeless rights back in 1988. He's a black man. He's living here in the Santa Cruz area, and he's a medical marijuana patient, and he's been harassed by police, and this is his circumstance.
We're speaking to
Wilfredo de Jesus.
Papers, police reports, arrest records, sheriffs, coroner. What's this all about?
Well, on January 26th of 1998, the sheriff's department illegally came into my residence and claimed they took 60 plants. I am a medical marijuana patient. They took all of my medical adapters that I need to grow my medical herb, and I'm going into a process now to dealing with these people the 17th, February 17th.
What are you charged with?
Possession of marijuana, cultivation, possession marijuana for sales, and cultivation marijuana.
And was the city police as well as the deputies involved in this? What officers did this?
There's a sheriff. They got sheriff, detectives, and CHP.
So this took place outside the city limits?
Boulder Creek.
And how did the officers treat you when this happened? Were you present when they came in and took the plants?
Well, first of all, they came in the house illegally. They didn't have a warrant. They came for a complaint, a noise complaint, because we had a party there the night before, and the neighbors came by and told us that we was making too much noise, and we quit. The next morning, the police came. They knocked out our doors because of a set of noise complaints. It's kind of interesting why they didn't come last night. They had to come the next day. And they claimed they knocked
slow
on...
Slow response time, perhaps.
Response time. And they claimed they knocked on the door and came in the door and knocked on the door, and nobody heard them knocking on the door. There was at least six people in the living room. They came through the back door. Nobody invited them in. They claimed that they seen somebody smoking marijuana in the living room. That's why they had probable cause to just come in without nobody letting them in. Nobody let them in. At that time, they didn't have a warrant. They got a warrant while they was in process of detaining everybody there, and then they let everybody go that was there that spent the night from the party before and just kept three people. I am a dialysis patient. They didn't want to deal with me, and I told them it was my plants. I showed them my card and everything, and they still took the plants. They didn't want to deal with me because I had to be at dialysis at 4 o'clock. So they sent me on my way. They arrested two of my roommates. A week later, I get a letter from the DA, and they want me to go to the courthouse to get fingerprinted and photographed, because now I am charged also with cultivating and possession of marijuana for sale. But it's not for sale. It's for my own use. So now they have to prove that I'm selling. And I'm not selling no herb. I'm not a drug dealer. None of that. I'm just a resident of Santa Cruz fighting for my rights. 215. And I'm going to fight these people all the way till I get my herb back and all my stuff.
Good for you. Do you have any legal assistance from any volunteer attorneys, or are you paying for an attorney? What's happening with that?
Well, right now I went the other day and paid $25, which money I don't have, $25 to the lawyer's referral service. Right now I don't have a lawyer. I guess they're going to appoint me. This will be my first time going to court. They'll probably appoint me a lawyer. I try to get in contact with people at the Santa Cruz Cannabis Club. I don't know what's happening with them. I want to find out what's happening with all these marijuana advocates. I need help. I need marijuana advocates to help a medical marijuana patient that is in need.
Now, what has their response been so far?
Well, they said that the lawyer that works there for them, she's too busy or something. I don't know. I left a whole bunch of messages and everything. Nobody got back to me from there.
Are you a member of that club?
Yes, I was a member, but I got suspended because all these federal things happening. My, I guess my credentials, how I got in the club, is not up to the new standards. But I was a patient there. Matter of fact, I'm the 100-something member there.
When did you become a member? How long ago?
About a year and a half ago.
When were you suspended from membership?
I don't know when all this stuff came down with all this thing with the feds and stuff. So they kind of like evaluating everybody, and if your credentials is not right, they're kicking you out.
By the thing with the feds, you mean the federal government's determination to close down marijuana clubs as providing marijuana illegally in spite of the mandate of the voters that clubs will be allowed, or I should say providers will be allowed to provide patients who medically need marijuana under Proposition 215.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I'm talking about. But I'm trying to get some advocates. I called the other club, WAM, and try to talk to somebody there, some Valerie something.
Valerie Corral?
Yes, and still nobody has got any contact with me. So, like right now, I'm trying to get some advocate or something. Some people to try to help me and stuff from having this to stop happening, because 215 is supposed to be in effect, and they're still harassing marijuana patients, coming and cracking in their house, coming in illegally, because they came in illegally into the house. Nobody invited them in. They didn't have no warrant. They claimed they knocked on the door, and they claim...
When is your next date?
February 17th, supposed to be plea bargaining, but I'm not pleading. I'm not wrong for anything. I'm standing up for my rights. 215.
These misdemeanors or felonies you're charged with?
Well, they say felonies. I guess they're felonies.
Perhaps you should... are you seeking a public defender? How are you going to deal with this legally?
Public defender. I don't have no money. I just get SSI, and I have no money at all.
This is the evidence against you here in front of you, these police reports?
Yeah, these papers, copies and stuff. Yeah, you can look at them.
Okay. And the landlord has responded negatively to this?
Yes, the landlord is evicting us. She doesn't want to evict us, but I guess they're kind of like forcing her, telling her that if she doesn't give us some type of notice, I guess they they say that she's involved with it or something like that. I don't know. So she's afraid to take the house. So she has to give us
an eviction. How do you know that they pressured her?
Because after that, she came and gave us a three-day notice, and then she called back, and she talked to one of my roommates. I subleased there. A friend of mine is the one that has the lease. And she told us what actually happened, you know, that somebody that just moved up in that neighborhood called the police because they see a couple of maybe dark-skinned rosters up there in Boulder Creek and called the police and said that...
I guess they saw what? I'm sorry.
Oh, they said this lady was the one that called the police. We found out it was a lady that called the police and told the police, this is in the report and everything, that she has a feeling there's too many people going in and out of there day and night, and that she has a feeling that we're selling drugs there. That's the reason why they really came. They didn't come for the complaint.
I see.
And then they got the warrant and all that, I put them later, but they wrong. And the landlord is giving us time to get out and stuff, but she doesn't really want her to do that, but I guess... I don't know how that thing they force or whatever, the RICO Act, you know, she's scared of the RICO Act that can take her house or whatever, because the police maybe can implicate her in my medical marijuana. She ain't got nothing to do with my medical marijuana. I'm allowed to grow.
Have you contacted San Francisco Medical Marijuana Club, or have you gone to the media at all with this stuff? Is there any media coverage on this? Any?
No. I talked to... May Wong from the Sentinel, and told her about it, and she supposed to got back to me, and she never got back to me. There was no coverage or nothing.
So you were describing Wilfredo, the party the night before. What were you saying?
Yeah, there was a party the night before. That was, I think that was one of the main reasons they came. They said it was some type of noise complaint. It was a party. We had a party. We had at least between 30 and 40 people. And there was one beer. And I also stretched that out to the police. I told them, look, we had a party last night. You can see what kind of people we are, because they kept asking us if we had guns or we had mushrooms or where's the crank and all this stuff. And we tell them that we Rastas, and I am a Rastafarian. I'm also fighting this because it's my religious right to grow and smoke marijuana. So I told them that, I stressed it to the police and told them that, you know, we had a party here the night before, and you can look around, and there's only one beer bottle. Person brought one beer bottle last night. And that person asked, can he drink it before he brought it in? And we said, yeah, because it was cool. We're not about alcohol, we're not against it really, but that's how that goes, you know, what kind of people we are. They kept saying that we got guns and crank and stuff, because everybody knows Boulder Creek is a brewing place for crank. Even the police was telling us, he was saying that after 9 o'clock, over 50% of their calls are alcohol-related. The police said he never had problems with anybody that's growing herb. There's never no arms or no guns. They kept asking us if we had guns. We told them we don't carry guns. We're not about violence.
And yet they still, they arrested three people and then they charged you, right?
They arrested two people that day. One of my friends got bailed out. The other one, they let him go. 2 days later at the arrangement or whatever, they let him go. And me, they didn't arrest me, but they want me to go downtown before the 17th, turn myself in to get fingerprinted.
Now, have the other people left town, or are they still around?
No, they're still here. We're fighting this. 215, we're fighting.
Have they found attorneys? Or?
One of them got a public defender, and the other friend of mine, I guess he's going to get a public defender this week when we go to court.
Well, now it sounds like business as usual here in beautiful Santa Cruz County.
Always business as usual.
And that was Wilfredo. talking about another one of Sheriff Tracy's cannabis busts up in supposedly a county that has passed its own resolution okaying medical marijuana. And, of course, it's part of a state that has passed a law making medical marijuana legal for folks who need it. But apparently not in Santa Cruz County, at least not for this man. We're going to be following this case further. Now, however, we're going to try to cram in a whole bunch of stuff before the end of the show. We end at 1:30. You're listening to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. This is a show that happens every Sunday at 11, goes to 1:30, and every Thursday at 6, goes to 8. We've got a couple guests in the studio we're going to introduce to you in a moment, but first, a kind of a brief update. For those who say the sleeping ban is dead, as Mike Rotkin often says, he talks about reasonable enforcement under the camping ban, officers using their discretion, only ticketing in high abuse areas, only ticketing on complaint. Not so. I was in court on Tuesday, and I found it was 9 or 11 sleeping ban tickets, and the claim has been that there's only 3 issued a month. Well, that seems to be quite a pileup for one day. Actually, 6 of those tickets were for Tama. You may remember Tama earlier, the homeless activist who recently died. And all these tickets came with failure to appear warrants, which many homeless tickets do, because people who are trying to run around and engage in survival activity don't have time to run to court to play games about when they're given a piece of paper because they happen to sleep at night. And the police officers decided it was time to run them out of that situation. Rolling Thunder Michael Sheridan, who does a program on this station, or used to, called the Bad News Hour, great program about current events in different parts of the city, country, and the world, and who currently isn't appearing because he's too busy keeping up with tickets like sleeping ban tickets, himself went to court recently, and he got, got 65 hours of community service for 2 sleeping tickets. It says instead of earning $5.75 an hour at minimum wage, our new minimum wage, he is going to be having to do essentially slave labor and pay for the privilege of doing it, by the way, $25 fee, simply because he had to sleep at night and he slept in his vehicle. He was targeted by Officer Perry, also known as RoboCop, who admitted he hadn't gotten a complaint about Sheridan, admitted that he was treating him differentially because he didn't go after nearby vans that were more opulent and more upscale and more upper middle class, but went after this poor homeless activist, Michael Sheridan. And so he's suffering the consequences of that. We had another report of a jeweler, a street jeweler, who I know, don't want to name him at the moment, although actually we're going to interview him in a future show. We have an interview which we're trying to dredge up. He was ticketed on the street for, actually wasn't just ticketed, his jewelry, he has actually a box of stones, was taken away from him because a host allegedly saw him giving a stone to another person. He said he was giving it to that person as a sort of a memorial for another person who had died. But the host told the police department about it. The police officer came over to him and said the next day, "We're taking all your stones, and we'll give them back to you when you get a job." This was his story, and you'll be able to hear it directly from his mouth in a future show. We also have with us in the studio activist David Silva, who's going to talk about a number of issues around the political scene. David's very savvy, but he had his own. There was his own account that he received. A man he spoke to who was told to get out of town by police. David, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, where I do my shopping, there's a fellow who often is panhandling there. He's just known by everybody that shops there. His name's Mike. He's a very sweet man, probably in his late 30s. He has a dog, and he has a sign. And he never approaches anyone. He never speaks to anyone. Never is abusive or forceful. Just a very nice guy. And I was speaking to him yesterday, and he told me that Officer Rodriguez had come up to him and told him that he needed to get out of town. He didn't have a job. He was no good. And if he didn't get out of town, next time he sees him, he's going to take his dog away from him. So I reported this to Mayor Celia Scott. I really have lost pretty much faith in the Citizens Police Review Board process. I've lost faith in reporting anything directly to the police. It's just sort of, you know, you might think, well, this is just one mild instance, someone being threatened by a police officer. But, you know, I think what we're dealing with when we're dealing with a sleeping ban, with this sleeping ordinance, is that we've given we've given them too much law to work with. We've got a bad law, and what's happened is that, you know, bad laws make bad cops, and so we're actually training cops to be bad. We're making them think that they work for the downtown association rather than for the citizens of Santa Cruz by this law. Well, there, I hear reports over and over and over again of bad police behavior. When I say bad, I mean real direct violations of the Constitution. I mean, they shouldn't even think in the terms that they speak of. You know, to tell someone that they have to have a sign, they have to have proof on them that they're disabled before they're allowed to have their sign say that they're disabled. This particular incident, disabled vet that I know has been at this one on Pacific Avenue panhandling for I don't know how long. Arbitrarily, the police can decide that they're going to run someone out of town. So this whole thing, as a matter of fact, when I spoke to the chief of police recently about the sleeping ban and why won't their point man speak to me, at least so I can make sure that we're all on the same page, that, you know, we stay on point with this debate with the repeal of the sleeping ban, the chief of police told me that, you know, they need this law as a tool to correct bad behavior. Well, then make a law against the bad behavior itself. Sleeping is not bad behavior. Sleeping is necessary, and it's human. It's a human right. It's a question of human dignity. It's a question of it's an animal right. I mean, my God, it's like how much more basic can you get than, you know, air, water, food? You know, we don't even think in terms of providing shelter for people, but at least we should allow them the right to sleep. I mean, you know, if they can't have food, and if they can't have water, and they can't have restrooms, they should at least be allowed to sleep. It's just unthinkable that we got ourselves in this position in this city, and it's a curse on this city. Actually, it's a curse, and it's a wound to our soul. It's a scar on our heart, and we need to correct this. So this is what I'm going to be keeping my focus on. There's a lot of things wrong with city council. There's a lot of things wrong with city government. There's a lot of things wrong when you look at how our elected officials are just bowing before the developers and preparing way for even more massive evictions and more homelessness. How they're not standing up to the eviction crisis that we're having in this city. That, you know, the true outsiders are no longer the deadheads that are coming through town. The true outsiders are the absentee landlords that, you know, that are living very well in Tahoe and living very well in parts of Florida, and they are just arbitrarily, whenever if there's some plumbing broken, they'll evict someone and raise the rent next time so they can play for the plumbing. If there's a roof leak, they'll evict someone or raise the rent and keep raising the rent and raising the rent. The causes of homelessness need to be addressed. There's lots of social services problems that need to be addressed, but one thing we can begin with, that we can change the mindset, begin to shift the mindset of our public servants, the police officers, and there are good police officers out there, but if they are required to enforce bad, immoral, unthinkably horrible laws like a law against the sleeping of a human being, you know, then until we do that, I don't think we're going to make much headway in the other fields. So I think this repeal of the sleeping ban is very important. That's why I'm going to try to keep my focus on this year. There's so much, you know, the massive right-wing conspiracy, you know, the threat of war. There's so much for us to be concerned with. But let's bring back a little heart to the city of Santa Cruz.
Well, thank you, David Silva. That's, again, your eloquence dwarfs my.
Oh, yeah.
Pathetic attempts to raise this issue, but I'm glad we have you with us. Let me turn, instead of asking, I was going to ask you a number of questions about, you got a potential endorsement from the People's Democratic Club, which is the old line, kind of Rotkin political hack city, out of which all the city council, many of the city council members have been birthed. Certainly that endorses them. And you've been seeking endorsements from a number of other agencies, but isn't the real priority for the sleeping ban to get people out there with petitions, getting the signatures of registered City of Santa Cruz voters?
Yeah, we're just about full up with endorsements. I don't think there's hardly a progressive or even just a conscious, whether it be religious or political organization out there, that hasn't taken up our initiative and has endorsed us. There are the People's Democratic Club, I've made a presentation to them. I wouldn't say that they're up to, you know, to pass it. There is a lot of the old roots of this problem. Why we have this problem in the first place are, you know, amongst some of the members of the People's Democratic Club. But I felt very comfortable when I was at the People's Democratic Club. I was at a meeting that was just the first half hour was sort of announcements and a little bit of business, and then the meeting after that was a debate on globalization. I guess there's some Democrats that think that what Clinton's doing is quite okay. But anyway, the endorsements that we have are just phenomenal. The amount of support we're getting. We're planning to have in the future, a couple of church days where we'll actually have all our petitioners out in front of churches. So when you're coming out of your particular church service, you'll see a petitioner out there. Or if you belong to a particular church and you'd like to come join us and be one of those petitioners out there, we really need it. We need to have, we're going to be having a few big push days, which will get us over the hump. Right now we're kind of struggling with the weather, struggling with no interns this quarter. Hopefully we'll have interns next quarter. We're struggling to get those petitions out there. So we need petition carriers more than anything else right now. Every meeting I go to make an endorsement, if for some reason they don't actually make the endorsement at the time, let's say they're concerned that they receive money from the city, so therefore their quasi-agency status may be in jeopardy, or nonprofits can take this petition up if their nonprofit activity is related to homelessness or related in some way to human rights. They can take it up. But if they are a quasi-agency of the city government, then there's some question whether they can do that. But they do, at those meetings, take the individual petitions themselves. So we have a lot of individual petitions from a lot of different organizations that we attended. March 28th is going to be the scan, another scan. There's not too many candidates for positions that really is going to be endorsing, so just the first half hour will be an endorsement meeting, and after that will actually be a working, getting the people out in the streets with the sleeping van initiatives out into the streets and carrying them in the neighborhoods. You will find, if you take up on these petitions, and I've done it, just walking your street, your own street, is very rewarding. Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, moderates, business owners or not, they are 90% of the people are signing this petition. On my street, I got 100%. So I would say it's a real easy sell. It's a basic human right, and it's just never been taken to the people before. It's been too much entangled in development politics.
Well,
Laura.
Thank you, David. And if you want to, of course, be a part of this effort, you can give a call to the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban at 457-9754 extension, and I've got it this time, 182. Or you can call me at 423-HUFF, easier to remember, and I'll hook you up. Or you can come to our meeting in 10 minutes at the 706 Frederick Street, where we'll be hustling over to go there, and you can check it out. That's the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
So, I just want to say, I can't think of anything that I could possibly say that's more important than what David just said. And we really, really, I want to see this on the ballot, so...
We're talking, by the way, to Laura Tucker, Citizens Committee. Hang on a second there, Radio Land. Okay. Citizens Committee for the Homeless board member, another board member. We actually had one earlier today. And, Laura, actually, I wanted to ask you before we reach the end of the show, you recently attended a board meeting of the Citizens Committee to exploit the home. I'm sorry, for the homeless, the board that covers the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program. I see you have your baby with you here.
Yes.
Very cute.
Any comments? I love my godfather, he says.
Yeah, we're playing. It takes a whole radio station to raise a baby, I guess. Anyway, you're on the board of the CCH, Citizens Committee to Exploit of the Homeless, for the homeless. I always get confused quite what it means. This community house project, the $2 million project to put up 20 to 40 people, and of course to move off 200 to 300 campers. I guess usually less than that, but certainly at its height, the Coral Street Open Air Shelter had that many campers. Is coming down the pike. Can you give us a kind of what happened at the last meeting? And you kind of had some strong feelings about some things that happened at the last meeting. What was that about?
I think the most disturbing thing to me that happened at the last meeting was
Board of Directors meeting, the Citizens Committee for the Homeless.
Yes, that we voted 5-4 to have Karen Gillette, who right now runs the Homeless Community Resource Center, be our only applicant. That we're going to put together a hiring committee, and she will be our only applicant. So there won't be
only applicant for what?
For the executive director position of Community House. So there
I
will.
I think that's against the law if they're using city funds.
There will not be open hiring.
That's against the law.
Okay, well,
executive director of Community House, or is this executive director of?
I was wondering about that.
Or is this executive director of the group that oversees both Community House and the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program?
The executive director would oversee Community House. The this is actually a proposed grid. Would be executive director oversees three things: the emergency services, which includes the ISSP program and the Homeless Community Resource Center, then an administrative office, and Community House. So it's a big job.
Would she continue in her position as head of the Homeless Community Resource Center, which is the, of course, you know, the day shelter and the phones and the lockers and the meals?
She would oversee that, but it's all up in the air right now exactly what it's going to look like, or if we're even going to merge. We may not.
What you're talking about the Homeless Community Resource Center and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless merging.
Right, which they're getting a lot of pressure from City Council to merge. We may not, but we're getting a lot of pressure to merge. And this all pretty much came from the whole idea, I think, came from Catherine Byers, who's on the City Council, and she's been getting pressure to for us all to merge together.
Why would there be this pressure to merge? I know in the past the Homeless Community Resource Center has been, in a way, more successful financially and perhaps better run in terms of it organizationally than the CCH, which we know has often been in the red and has been having problems with raising funds.
Well,
and
they're really, CCH has gotten it together quite a bit since Carol Shannon has been hired as our director. The pressure is because everybody will be sharing the same site down there, and they think it would be better if it was all kind of run by the same group. I'm also confused as to how, apparently it is legal, I don't understand how, that we have two groups with 501c3 status, which is nonprofit status, that are merging to one, but they will still be two.
Okay, I don't know. These are start technicalities. I'm afraid our audience is probably not going to be able to follow. Okay. However,
the Homeless Garden Project failing has a lot to do with this.
The substantial thing here, however, is you said you objected to there being a closed hiring process whereby Karen Gillette is the only candidate for the big cheese in this project.
That's right. And my consideration is, first of all, if we don't decide. If we decide not to take Karen, we have no other applicants to choose. That's one. Also, she has said that she's been offered a bigger, better job somewhere else, and that if we don't give her this position, that she's going to move on. So that is why everybody's afraid to lose Karen. So that's why we've decided not to do open hiring.
You're talking about Karen Gillette, who I've called QC Karen, Queen of the Cupcakes, also called her the Day Center Duchess. My criticism of Karen Gillette has often been that she has, for example, championed a closed process, meetings that were not open to the homeless. Her own board of the Homeless Community Resource Center refused to give out their board meeting times and allow individuals to come into their meetings. They were closed meetings. What is your objection to Karen, if anything? Do you object to her?
I object to not having an open hiring process. And I also have concerns about that Community House is going to be a clean and sober environment, and I think that somebody needs a little bit more experience with.
She's fumbling here. Could you be saying something about Karen Gillette's? Should we say? Smoking but not inhaling? I know she was accused by the media of smoking marijuana or something. Certainly you don't fault. I'm an occasional smoker of marijuana. I'll admit it on the air. Do you have some objection to people smoking marijuana? Aren't you being something of a prude here?
Oh, well, I don't object to anybody smoking marijuana. I feel like all drugs should be legal, and I have a lot of reasons for that. On the other hand, I think if it's a clean and sober environment, we need someone with more experience with the recovery and people in recovery. And maybe she has that. I don't know. But
I want there to be multiple candidates.
I want to see open hiring. That's really, really what it is. And she might be the best woman for the job, but how do we know if we only interview her?
Now, Dr. Alan Baer, who's the board of directors of CCHNU, had a sort of a pungent exchange both before and after the meeting. What was that all about?
He's right now the chairperson of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which he chose to tell some extremely tacky and in very bad taste homeless jokes at the end of the board meeting.
Can you give us an example of what you consider to be a tacky homeless joke?
A homeless person came up to me the other day and said, I haven't eaten in 3 days, and I said, well, perhaps you should try forcing yourself. It was a real, you know, dumb jokes, but...
And wasn't there something about I'll pay you on payday? Tell us about that.
They were bad jokes, but I found that it was...
The board chair of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless.
So I called...
At an official board meeting, correct?
I told him, that I found they were in bad taste and asked him to stop, which he did. And then I woke up the next morning angry.
Did you ask him to resign as well, and can we hope that he had the same reaction?
I talked to him the next day. I called him on the telephone, and he was upset that I tried to... he had a right to freedom of speech, and that other people shouldn't be able to dictate his humor, and that he's Jewish, and he doesn't mind anti-Semitic jokes.
He certainly has a right to take a crap in the bathroom, but does he have a right to take a crap in the middle of a CCH meeting on the floor, I think is the question.
Well, I mean, I believe in freedom of speech, and so he can really do whatever he wants, and it's hard to get someone to chair that meeting, so... So anyway, we did come to a little bit more peaceful conversation towards
what about this man's past record? Has he done other positive things you'd like to comment on, or have there been negative things? What's your sense about the direction in which he's leading the Citizens Committee to exploit the for the homeless?
Well, I talked to him about that too. I think a lot of my concerns are there's a lot of upper middle class doctors, clergy, a city council member, that type of people on the board, and I don't know that they really have quite the same, I think that they're a little bit brainwashed as to what the homeless community looks like and what's okay, whether it's okay to tell jokes about them or not,
Get beyond the jokes. What about substantial behavior in the past? We have another board member here, Becky Johnson. Becky, you've been on the board for, a year and a half. How would you sum up Dr. Alan Baer and his contributions to CCA?
Well, he was the one that turbo-tabled my proposal to reopen Coral Street Field that had been sitting empty long after the campground had been evicted. And rather than even allow it discussion to take place. He moved to table it.
The way Mike Rotkin turbo-tabled the winter shelter emergency at City Council?
I think he actually was the first one who thought of it, because the Mike Rotkin turbo-tabling took place a month later in December. This was in November.
Mike is taking notes at the knee of Dr. Alan Baer.
Yeah, and it was seconded by Reverend Jim Lapp of St. Stephen's Lutheran Church. So I got this medical doctor and a Lutheran minister to table any discussion of reopening the campground allow homeless people a place to sleep.
In all fairness, it doesn't have to be said that Catherine Byers, the great liberal extraordinaire of the city council, herself essentially turned on the proposal and stabbed it in the back, even though she earlier had said she was supporting it.
Yeah, she absolutely assured me that she didn't even dare raise the topic at among other city council members, that it was just absolutely hopeless, that there was no one on the city council who would be in favor of reopening the campground at Coral Street.
We're talking about during a period of time when the campground was, when there was no community house project there. Actually, community house trailers began to be moved in a couple months ago, so this could have actually been done month after month. Laura, you've been trying to say something.
I was just going to say we were also unsuccessful at getting an endorsement for repealing the sleeping ban from the Citizens Committee for the Homeless because they were concerned about their 501(c)(3) status. SCAN wasn't concerned
incorrectly
about that.
So.
There's several organizations that have 501(c)(3) status that were not concerned, but that was their reason for not endorsing the repeal of the sleeping ban. But I do want to say, too, that I feel like these people are misguided, but I don't know that they do. I think they are on the board for a reason, and that they do want to to contribute to homeless services. So I just want to find a way to bridge the gap.
Bridge that gap.
You know what you find is that you'll find people that are on these boards. There's some on the Homeless Community Resource Center board, some on our board, who really are anti-homeless. They don't know homeless people. They have very biased opinions towards homeless people. They consider homeless people all alcoholics, drug addicts, and mental cases. And
the occasional good homeless person.
And they better be working, too. You know? These people are really out of touch with what homeless people want and need, and exhibit a lot of classism. Maybe it's internal, and they're not really aware that they're doing it. Some may be very flagrantly doing so. I know that, say, Donna Murillo on Homeless Community Resource Center, or Linda Steinau, just the policies that they advocate are so anti-homeless. It's just a joke that they're on boards.
She just did. So I'm afraid we'd like to continue further with this savaging of decent citizens who are just trying to help the homeless, as Mike Rodkin likes to put it, who have done more for the homeless than any other community, and so on. But we have our next programmer, and waiting patiently with Skidmark Bob, who's going to kind of lead you slowly into the into the next show, Reckless's show. So we're going to fucking it up in a fucked society, as she puts it in her inimitable fashion. Music for brainwash kids. Do I have to keep repeating this? Everybody can hear what he's saying, can't you? So in the meantime, let's segue out, probably jumping into the middle of a Tom Paxton song that we were listening to before, Something Is Wrong With the Rain. Invite you to stay with us, at least for Reckless, and come back again on Thursday at 6.
When you might actually hear that Santa Monica tape we almost heard.
Yeah, you might actually hear the interview with Jennifer Wagoner, the editor of Making Change, the homeless street paper in Santa Monica. And you'll be hearing more, hopefully even some original cuts from the Rotkin-Norris debate. You'll hear these two big bozos slashing it out together. Very interesting stuff. I want to thank my guests, Tough Love Laura Tecker, Beggerbacker Becky Johnson, and Dead On Dave Silva, for coming and being my backup team here. And stay with us for Reckless.